Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
On the 15th of December at the Camden Powerhouse in London Town. Well, not Santa Claus, but me, cabaret legend Lenny Beige, as I host my very special Regency Rooms Christmas extravaganza. It's an old-school variety show with some of the names that made my club the talk of the town and some of the very best new acts working the circuit today. Plus, there might even be a household name or two thrown in for good measure. Add to that a band of world-class session players, and you've got the greatest Christmas variety show out there. There's literally no show like it. Tickets are from £25. Just visit ctickets.com. That's ctickets.com and enter Regency Rooms and get booking.
Right, hello and welcome to Footballistically Arsenal. I am Boyd Hilton. Josh, psychic Josh isn't with us this week. He is not available. I'm sure he'll be back next week. But coming in to the first team is the one and only Footballistically Arsenal superstar, Alan Elgar. Hi, Alan.
How are you doing, Boyd?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Very well indeed.
I say good. I'm a bit tired because I was up at till about 3:30 watching Succession on season finale last night. But I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine.
I haven't got into it. You highly recommend it. I've seen your tweets.
Yeah, so you need to get on board, Alan.
Give it a go. I will indeed.
I think you'd enjoy it. So it's just a one-on-one. It's one of our rare. It's like, as I often compare it to Elsie and Dot on EastEnders.
Ethel and Dot.
Sorry, you're right. Elsie is different. In fact, Elsie was at the football. Dom Baldwin was there with his daughter Elsie, his lovely, cute daughter Elsie. And it was her first trip to the football. First trip to the Emirates.
She can come again.
I think she was suitably dazzled by the whole thing. So that was good. So we were both there on Saturday, we should say, in the Southampton game. My first question is, does our 3-0 triumph against Southampton on Saturday at the Emirates cancel out the horrendous defeat of last week, not so long ago?
Well, the problem with that, and I'm assuming you're talking about the Everton game.
Sorry, the Everton game, yeah.
The problem with that is that Everton were soundly beaten again yesterday.
Yeah.
And if you look at their last 12 Premier League fixtures, they have two draws and only one win and nine defeats. And obviously that one win was in that game against us. And again, and I'm not making excuses for Arteta here, but you know, the highlights DVD of bad decisions since he's been our manager that have gone against us are, I mean, it's getting longer by, you know, you could fill an hour with the bad decisions that he has somehow had against his team out on the pitch. The old interpretation of VAR, where they looked and looked and looked and looked and made sure there was something there. You know, I'm the biggest case of that, I'm thinking, is David Luiz at Wolves, you know, where they tried to make out he touched the player. I think he had a similar one at Man City. Now they've been told, because of the Euros being so successful, you must make decisions very quickly. The guys that are looking at the video are going to look at it as you continue play or get ready to restart play, and we're going to try and keep the game flowing. Now that they're not looking for anything obvious, and it has to be absolutely blatant, we're still not getting things that you could even call blatant. So I really think that Everton game needs to be looked at under that microscope, with the fact that for some bizarre reason, Mikel Arteta has been one of the unluckiest managers we've ever had in terms of bad decisions. But there are a few things from that Everton game that weren't in the sort of in the gift of the referee. And I still think we failed in a lot of areas, which must have either been instruction or the players not listening to him, which is a massive thing. Either way, that's a big thing. And I approached the Southampton game thinking that we would be fine. I didn't think it'd be a vintage performance. The first 20 minutes, wow. I mean, it was dicey because...
They could have been 3-0 up,
They had lots of chances where if we'd have been playing a better team in better form, we'd have gone 1 or 2 down. And then it really would have been difficult. But praise the character of the team, because once we got that goal, and what a great goal, you know, what an amazing team move. Once we got that goal, it didn't look like Southampton would creep back into the game at all.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the team do deserve credit for that, because that's, you know, that's 70 minutes. It's just that Southampton had their period of pressure all at the start of the game. So it made it look a bit skewed in that sense, because we were all panicking, thinking, you know, we've got to get a grip on this game. They came there without, you know, with a third choice goalkeeper, fourth and third
40 years old, 40 years old goalkeeper.
Yes. A fourth and third choice centre-back pairing, and holding midfielders that wouldn't necessarily play that deep. Ward-Prowse wouldn't necessarily play that deep, as deep as he did, because there's no other options for them. So look, all those circumstances there, you've got to beat what's in front of you. A 3-0 home victory is, you know, a huge tick in the box. But I don't think it allays any fears that we have about Arteta's management. But it doesn't pile anything else on the "we need to look at this" pile either. So,
just on the first thing you said with the Everton game being the latest example of decisions going against us, VAR. I mean, first of all, in that game particularly, Everton were pretty unlucky with their two disallowed, their goals that were offside. I mean, they were offside, but they were fairly. Do you know what I mean? They would consider themselves unlucky that happened. You know, they were very
objective calls.
Sure. Oh yeah. No. I know. But my question.
Objective calls that come against.
Sure. So they could have had a player sent off easily, couldn't they? Yeah. In that game.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
Yeah. But are you saying? But just to clarify. You're not saying that these decisions that have been going on for a long time that have gone against us are some kind of conspiracy? Do you? What's the explanation?
I really don't know, because I was saying, you know, on previous appearances on this podcast and in my Guna column, it's not just a few little things where you're happy to put it down to the ebbs and flows of football. And, you know, we've been a bit unlucky there a couple of times. I think, and I'm not saying it's a conspiracy against us, although you do have to, have that in the back of your mind, because I can honestly say there are at least 20 incidents, maybe approaching 30, where I think we've had the wrong decision given against us, and it's impacted games, and it's impacted the Premier League performances. Obviously, VAR is majority used in the Premier League rather than the cup games that we play in. And I just think that we've suffered at the hands of the worst interpretation of the old way of doing things and the new way of doing things. And I'm not one that ever used to make excuses about referees and decisions, because I do believe that it at least evens itself out, or you're not left with a deficit too much either way. I genuinely think we've been left with a deficit of maybe 20 to 30 bad decisions. And that has to be unprecedented in the lifetime of the club. Has to be.
Yeah, I mean, that is, but what is the explanation? Like, are we the kind of team? Are we the kind of team that referee? I mean, I don't know. I think it is. I think it's just coincidental, isn't it? I just think we've been on the.
I referee quite a lot. I mean, it's obviously kids' football. It's not the pressures of the Premier League and you know what you get given as a Premier League referee. You know, you're listening in your ear. You've got obviously the linesman speaking to you, VAR. You've got the fourth official. You've got the TV companies telling you when to kick off. I mean, there are loads of other factors going on. But I don't think anyone sort of sets out to be biased when they referee a game. It just wouldn't be worth it in any sense. But I do think that referees take a certain attitude against Arsenal, and they maybe have that as a preconceived idea of what we're like as a team before they start the game, and they might not admit to that, and it might even be a little
subconscious. Yeah.
Because I think they do. I think they maybe are. Maybe they are influenced by the old Arsenal are weak. You know, they don't like challenges. They aren't strong when they're on the pitch, and maybe challenges that are against us are seen as exactly that we've been a little bit weak in the challenge. I still think that's obviously completely wrong, but it might be an explainer for some of the
things
that just get completely overlooked. But VAR is meant to stop that, because it does take it out of the moment for the ref, and they are able to look at it. And I don't see how you can look at there were two really poor challenges. You had the stamp and the follow through high foot. Possibly two reds in that game. And we've definitely seen similar situations interpreted as reds in the Premier League in the last year. We're just not getting the rub of the green with those decisions.
I think a lot of the VAR decisions, as you say, that where they've changed it from last season's kind of, they will study anything and they will change the referee's decision, no matter what. They're much more reluctant, aren't they? And that, I mean, over the weekend there were loads of penalty decisions, weren't there, which I think favoured the big teams. It struck me that VAR should possibly have intervened in or changed the mind of the referee, which last season they probably possibly would have done. So I think it's not just us, but I do agree with you. I think maybe Arsenal's one of the few teams, aren't they, I think, that has a reputation. That is very easily identified, isn't it? It's like it's when you look at pundits on TV, the way that, you know, the Gary Nevilles and the Jamie Carragher's of this. Like Jamie Carragher, whenever he does an Arsenal match, I think it's really interesting. He always says, I defend Arsenal, you know, against all the critics, but we all know what all those critics are saying. And so, yeah, there's definitely is that kind of idea that Arsenal are kind of weak, slightly lily-livered, slightly kind of brittle
I think the referees might have it in their heads. I think they might, and just as
they're only human. Back to the Southampton game, though. I thought it was interesting, because I'll be honest with you, right? I do think they could have been 3-0 up quite easily, Southampton. They had some good decent chances, and we were absolutely terrible to start with, I thought. And I was, first of all, I thought the team selection, you know, I think in our WhatsApp group, I messaged saying, you know, unchanged, because considering he played so well with this team, I thought it was weird that he didn't change it at all, that he stayed with that team. And of course, in the end, they won. It was fine. But I thought to start with, I felt like we played exactly the same tedious approach to football as we did in the Everton game. And, you know, they were passing it around the back, you know, Xhaka, and it was just like the old horseshoe, backwards passing, sideways passing, not getting anywhere, while Southampton were being quite incisive and direct and more powerful. And I expressed that, and I think just as the move that ended up with our goal, with the first goal that Lacazette scored, was underway, which was ended up being we're passing it around the back a bit, and then, of course, with three or four incisive passes, perfect passes, really, and they had to be. I mean, they were just, you know, the goalkeeper was just about to be dispossessed, wasn't he, when Ramsdale, etc. And we scored that goal, which ended up being a brilliant goal, and everyone was, oh, this is a beautiful goal. But I don't know. I mean, it was a brilliant goal, don't get me wrong. But part of me is like, well, that it's slightly annoyed because that is Arteta ball, isn't it? Like, that's what he's trying to go for, that kind of perfectly executed move. And I think that's just misguided. I just think how, and it is very rare that you're going to get that kind of goal scored like that. I would say, you know, the vast majority of the time, you just, especially where we play it, you're passing it around the back and sideways and more often not conceding possession or it going off or for a throw in, or it just doesn't work like that very rarely. So it seemed incredible that we scored that goal. But I don't think it necessarily disproved the theory that Arteta's approach to attacking football is kind of misguided.
Yeah. I think, Tim Steelman, who obviously is a pretty well-known Arsenal fan, Steelberto on Twitter, he calls it the Goldilocks effect with Arteta's football, in that it needs to be just right. And I think you're exactly right in describing that move. The amount of people around me that were saying, "Oh, don't knock it about there," and then all sort of turning to whoever they were with, laughing.
Yeah.
30 seconds later, because the ball's in the back of the net. And when you watch it back on Match of the Day and, you know, you look at the highlights of the game, you think, wow, that, you know, Arsenal really knocked it about well there. But you're dead right in saying in the 20 minutes prior to that moment, there were a lot of misplaced passes in exactly the same fashion. And it was only that Goldilocks moment of everything being just right that meant that we did actually score from that situation. And a better team might have been one or two up. A better team might have stopped it. And the weird thing was, it was only when Southampton had overcommitted because they thought they were going to get something out of the game that actually occurred in the 20th minute. Because when it was happening before, they didn't have the number of bodies up there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Tomiyasu made a misplaced pass. Xhaka made a misplaced pass. Partey made a really bad one going backwards towards White, who then... he compounded that by making an even worse pass to the side. But Southampton weren't committed forward then. And you almost think maybe they got the shout from the sidelines. You might get a bit of joy here if you push up a little bit more. And in the 20th minute, they were heavily pushed onto us, giving us lots of pressure. We got out of it. And it reminded me a little bit of the goal against Man City in the Cup semi-final. Some way back, which was City right at the close point of closing us down, and the ball gets played and it is a good pass. And that happening five or six times is so unlikely. And that means that the majority of the time you're going to be watching that kind of thing with those moves breaking down. But he wants to persist with it, as we saw. He definitely wants to persist with it. And he can get away with that when you're winning 3-0, but if you don't look like you're on the front foot and slip a game 2-1 at Everton, it's exactly the same thing. It's for the same reasons, but it's worked out with a totally different outcome at the weekend. I used to say on here, we used to have the debate about players, and we say, I think, you know, we've had a decade of players where you could make a very good highlights reel to make them look amazing. You could have a highlights reel to make them look terrible. The truth is they're probably somewhere in between. I think now the whole team encompasses that view, where you could, again, make, you know, you could show the highlights of that goal and say, oh, we've really got it together. We're doing what we expected from a Wenger team back in the day. You know, sharp, intricate passes, passing the ball into the net. Making football look simple. But really, in reality, that 90 minutes wasn't football looking simple, and nor was the 90 minutes against Everton and prior to that. So, you know, you look at other home victories against poor teams. You know, you look at Newcastle's results since we edged them at home. We probably should have won that by more if we want to be classed as a top four team or even fifth or sixth in the league, because, you know, you look at what Leicester did the other day. Norwich, you know, obviously they're suffering heavy, heavy defeats. And that doesn't look good in context, that we only managed to beat them 1-0. So it is hard to be overly optimistic. But, you know, when I was a kid, I used to attend not so many games at Arsenal. So I'd probably only go 4 or 5 times a season when I first started going when I was 6 or 7. And to me, the league position was never in my head. It was just, did you turn up today? Did you win? And I'm sure Dan Baldwin's daughter feels exactly the same about her experience that day. It doesn't matter at all.
Dom's daughter, I should say.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. You don't know that. Dan did bring his 2 sons, actually, I should say. Harry and Chester. So they were those. It was a full family. It was a full Baldwin family occasion. Yeah. Carry on.
Those kids go home just knowing that Arsenal won 3-0 that day, and that will be their experience from the game. And it's only when you get to being an adult and you realise the context of the result and how does that look in context of a... So you don't enjoy it as much, do you?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure during some of those terrible seasons in the early 80s, I would go to an Arsenal game with my dad and my uncle, and we'd maybe win 2-0. We'd probably lost the previous 5 games or the next 5 games, but you still enjoyed it in the moment. And I think you've got to get a little bit of that back. And if you're winning 3-0 at home, you have to come off. If you're not coming out of the stadium thinking that's amazing.
But that's slightly because of what we've become, isn't it? Like, if Arsenal were, you know, we didn't think this way, you know, 15 years ago, because when we were really up there and, you know, we were competing with Man United and we you know, no one was going, oh, yeah, we just want to win this game and it's fine. So it's kind of like that's a reflection of where we've come, isn't it? Or how we've kind of drifted into being a kind of mid-table
Unfortunately, the next stage of that is only wanting to win your big games. Can we win against United and Tottenham? Great. I don't care about the rest of the season. If we go there, I mean, that's sinking again.
Yeah, that's an indictment.
That really is, you know, sinking again. But
Talking of Dan's son, Harry, Odegaard scored the second goal, his first ever header, I think. Yeah. And that's 3 goals in 3 games. And Dan has a famous, famous anti-Odegaard feeling. He doesn't like Odegaard. I mean, I'm being slightly simplistic about it, but he's not a big fan, put it that way. And I thought Odegaard had one of his better games on Saturday, and I said to Harry, who sat next to me, I said, does your dad go on about Odegaard a lot at home? You know, does he spend a lot of time banging on about? He's like, yeah, he does, yeah. So that was quite revealing. But he was pretty good, wasn't he, Odegaard? I thought, generally, scored, good header. But he doesn't really impose himself. Well, I mean, Odegaard, I guess, is a classic example of what you're talking about, isn't it? Where we don't really know, do we, whether he's good enough, whether he's kind of, you know, some games he has great moments most games, but I don't feel like he imposes himself on a game like the best kind of number 10s or the best, you know, attacking midfielders or attackers do. So I'm not convinced myself yet. You know, I think for the price we paid for him and for the ease of that deal going through, it probably made total sense to sign him. But, you know, who knows long term?
Yeah, particularly because we don't have a great deal of options there, especially if, you know, you're relying on 2 young players to be in that position during the season, Smith Rowe and Odegaard, then who else would you really pick there? If you pick Lacazette there in a slightly different role than he did at the weekend, as he did at Liverpool, you don't really get that much out of him. And Odegaard, from a midfield position, is now 3 from 3 in the Premier League. You're right, he doesn't impose or become a focal point of every single attack like you would expect the best number 10s to do, but is that his age or is that his limitation? I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I don't think you can be ultimately sure about many of the players that we have. I mean, I still think that, I mean, Tomiyasu's getting lots of praise at the moment. I still think that he might regress to some kind of mean where he doesn't defend as well, because his technique, for me, and we're using the word technique again, but I think sometimes he defends in such a way where there's a hell of a lot of luck based on he runs at the ball so quick that any quick, intelligent player will probably flick it out of his way and get past him. And I hope that doesn't happen on a regular basis, because it looks like there's a certain way to play him. And I think that happened at Liverpool.
He's a good outlet, though, isn't he? I mean, he's way better than the options that we had, you know, I think previously last season.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of Hector Bellerin. I've said it plenty of times.
Yeah, we know that. Yeah,
I'm glad he's no longer at the club, and Tommy Asu is definitely an upgrade. But I think if people go so far as to praising him as being absolutely incredible, they might see a little bit of a regression.
Sure.
Because of the way that he plays. I just think, you know, an intelligent winger or two will start to realise that he charges at you and you've just got to make a quick move out of the way and get past him. And then Tierney was a bit like that as well. And for what he gives in terms of his attacking intent and the way that he plays going forward, I think you can absorb that at home against Southampton. You probably can't do that if you're, I don't know, away against a decent team. So I think that's where we might start to find out about some of the players.
We'll talk more about the game, and we've got a big issue of Aubameyang to discuss as well after this break.
If you want an e-bike that doesn't look like it's made for the shopping precinct, something that's less Mr. Bean and more Steve McQueen, check out the range of bikes from London-based Cooler King. From dope 250-watt city bikes to Harley Bobber-inspired 750-watt beasts that can tear your face off while leaving your smile intact. Cooler Kings are made in limited numbers, yet highly affordable. Check them out now on the web at cooler.bike or find them on Instagram with hashtag CoolerKingBike. Cooler.bike. E-bikes that are cool AF.
And we're back from the break. I do like to be beside the seaside, still banging out that tune in the ad break. In and out of the ad break for no good reason whatsoever. But there we go. Before we go on to the Aubameyang issue, I just want to mention Martinelli, because I think he's been one of the big positives for me, even during this, you know, mediocre run. I think since he's come in, I just think he's kind of just exciting. You know, you think something exciting is going to happen when he's got the ball, and more often than not, something vaguely promising does happen. He's very hardworking, and I just think he's been a bonus, you know, and played a lot better, I think, than, because I would say when he's been in and out, he's had limited chances, you know, since that wonder goal against Chelsea. But he didn't really do that much, did he? A lot of the times when he came on as a sub, or he'd have like one game every, you know, few weeks of playing in a league game. But I think this run, he's doing really well.
Yeah. I completely agree. He is an exciting player. He is obviously going down the traditional route of playing wider while he's younger before being able to be a central striker, because he does have the skills and the finishing skills to possibly be that central striker, as you saw with, I think it was the goal against Newcastle, with the incredible finish. But he does make a hell of a lot of effort when he's on the pitch, and I think he has the right attitude. And he covered defensively numerous times at the weekend. And he's happy to get up and down the pitch. And you hope that there's a player in there that can sustain that if he's given the chances. Because I think you're right. His style of play isn't going to suit that 20 minutes here and there cup games. I think he does need a long run in the team and establish how you play a wide forward role for a team that, you know, if we're at home against Southampton, we're expected to have a lot of the ball, and you're expected to not only be an outlet, you're expected to be part of a three that are going to be winning the ball up front. I mean, Lacazette wasn't doing that at the weekend. And that was the interesting difference between Lacazette and Aubameyang being there. When Southampton kicked off and sent the ball back to their keeper, they had all the time in the world. Mm. Whereas with Aubameyang, he's usually right on that keeper straight away and forcing that. And you saw from the first 5 seconds of the weekend that Lacazette either hadn't been told to make those runs or couldn't or didn't want to. Because immediately it was the two wide players, Saka and Martinelli, that did that work for him. Which meant obviously the keeper did have a bit of a free rein to be kicking the ball up the pitch. And I actually think in a weird way with an old keeper like Caballero on, it might have been a bit better to have had someone there that was charging them down. But I think what we lost in terms of Aubameyang, I think Lacazette is just... I had that long, long debate, Lacazette or Giroud, a long time ago, 2-3 years ago. And I still maintain Giroud over Lacazette. But a lot of the things I said at that point, I think, have definitely been redressed. And I definitely would hold my hand up and say, he's a positive influence on the younger players. He gets on with it. He gets his head down. And he worked really, really hard on Saturday. And a lot of it was sort of almost unseen because it wasn't charging the keeper down, but it was really putting pressure on those that area between the centre-backs and the holding midfielders for Southampton. And a lot of our success came out of his sheer presence there. Some of their misplaced passes were because of that. And I think he's almost the anti-Aubameyang, because we don't really ever see Lacazette or hear Lacazette moaning. I being selective there? I mean, I don't.
No, I think you're right. Think you're like absolutely that, right.
Even when he's been left out of the team, he's always come back and just got on with whichever position he's told to play in. And I think that's huge credit to him. And
I think his attitude.
I owe him a bit of an apology on that front.
Oh, that's nice. I think his attitude is one of the reasons why I've always preferred him to Giroud in that long running debate. Because I think Giroud was a bit of a prick, you know. And it was like, Giroud was the kind of player who'd sit there in the penalty area, you know, feeling sorry for himself. That's happened a lot when, you know, something didn't go right. Whereas, you know, Lacazette is just always up and ready and willing and, as you say, really hardworking. For me, the really annoying thing is that he played Lacazette behind Aubameyang for two or three games, and it worked really well. Then changed his mind, and I think it's been since then that this kind of mediocre run has happened. Because I think the Lacazette and Aubameyang one behind the other was one of the best solutions to our issues.
Yeah, apart from at Liverpool, where you need someone
to complement.
I mean, look, I don't think you can start basing everything you do in a 38-game season on your most difficult game, which is away a side that, you know, just hit their peak that day and we couldn't compete. So I don't think we can judge all of the players or the manager on that particular day, but I don't think it worked having him there that day. It could have worked a bit better to have fresher legs in there, younger legs in there that we're going to actually get at Liverpool's midfield, because he was in an absolute no man's land between their defence and midfield. We weren't even getting the ball to that position anyway. And when you've got Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain running the midfield, you know you've had a bad day. So
about that. But the Everton game, like I think that kind of game, he definitely could and should have played, and I think we would have been far more effective in that game. But talking of Aubameyang, then we need to address this whole situation. I slightly tongue in cheek tweeted when it was announced that Arteta came out and told everyone that he dropped him for disciplinary reasons, which, you know, remember, he doesn't have to do. I mean, you know, people always say, oh, these stories always come out, but they don't always. I don't necessarily think this story would necessarily have come out, but he decided to make it public that he dropped him for disciplinary reasons. And I slightly jokingly said, well, you know, I'm not surprised if Aubameyang is going to have a disciplinary moment, because he's had to sit there while Eddie Nketiah was brought on when we needed a goal against Man United. And that was kind of humiliating. I think that decision was so mind-blowingly terrible on Arteta's part that it felt like a deliberate, especially like Eddie Nketiah, especially having to play out of position. Aubameyang would have been more natural on wide, playing wide, where he stuck Nketiah. And it was an extraordinary moment. And I think for me, it felt like a proper, like, you know, slap in the face from the manager to Aubameyang. And I'm not saying necessarily what happened subsequent to that, because apparently, according to David Ornstein knows these things, he went to France to get his mother to bring her back. He returned later than expected. That's what he got dropped for kind of lateness, basically, which has been an issue, I think, throughout his career, being late for stuff. Yeah. I remember reading about that before we transferred him. And so, but I just think, I know everyone's going to say he's the captain, he should set an example, and I kind of agree with that in theory, but in practice, I feel at that moment when Keti came on, and I think, and a few of the other ways that Arteta's treated him, I don't think he should be automatic selection, and I know he's been off form. I still think he's like 10 times the player Keti was, and I think that was a stupidest thing to do by Arteta. I think it's bad management. I think it was bad for the team and for the games. I think Aubameyang was a better person to bring on anyway, and I think this has ramifications for what's clearly happening now, this ongoing issue between Aubameyang and Arteta. Am I being I don't know, should I be more just critical of Arteta, of Aubameyang rather, sorry, for his disciplinary breach?
I think it's on the player, isn't it? I don't think he has the mentality to be a top level player, and I think he's already written that off in his head. He's in his early 30s now. He's nicked a few cups here and there, and that probably is what he sees himself as in terms of his career. He doesn't play for an international team that are going to be on the bigger stages of the World Cup. He'll obviously go to the Africa Cup of Nations, where they've got a sort of outside chance. He's their only real star player. In reality, I think he's settled in that mindset that he is a player that wins cups at a reasonably good team in a nice city in London. And I actually think there are not many managers, just to defend Arteta, I don't think there are many managers that could shake him out of that. I think that's what he is. I think that's how he sees himself. And I think he doesn't have that ruthless kind of edge that could turn him from... And, you know, look, we've seen him be top scorer in the Premier League.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. And,
but you look at the goals and the goals from open play, and that most of the open play goals are against poor teams. They're against poor teams or, you know, he's not popping up with vitally important goals. In the cup, he has. You know, look, I mean, he scored the last four goals of our last cup win. You know, two in the semi, two in the final. So don't get me wrong, he can perform on his day. But, I mean, the way he took his penalty against Tottenham towards the end of Emery's reign, which cost us fourth place, I thought it was a shocking approach. I mean, he addressed the ball lazily. It was a lazy penalty. It was such an important penalty. And I guess he just shrugged it off and just thought, it doesn't matter. I don't see him have that kind of passion for being any better than he is. I think he just, he knows what he is, and no manager's going to shake him out of that. And I think that makes him almost impossible to include in any long-term plans at the club. And if you can get a few quid for him in January or later on, I think you have to sell him. I think you have to draw a line under it. So I'll go further than you and say that he has to leave the club. I mean, I mean when you've got Piers Morgan defending you, you probably know that you've done wrong. Because Piers
what did
Morgan
Piers
was
say?
Out defending.
What did he say? Piers has blocked me on
he
Twitter, so I don't see him.
He said. He's blocked you, did you say?
Oh, yeah.
Has he really? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I've got him. I mean, he won't know who I am, but I've got him muted, so I don't really see him that often. But he did come across the timeline today, and he's defending Auburn, saying it's Arteta's fault and that he should be managed differently. But, look, you know, this is a guy that had the pictures done with AFTV, like pictures of other players scoring against Arsenal. I just think his mindset isn't of the highest quality that you need to carry his talent forward to being absolute world class, because he does have the talent. He doesn't have the attitude, I don't think. And he's a happy-go-lucky kind of player most of the time. I mean, when we had him and Lacazette starting that first season where they, you know, they are obviously great friends. And to me, that was... Oh, well, there you go. Yeah, I mean... Yeah.
I'm just showing Alan my framed photo of the two of them.
There was so much joy in that. And everyone thought, well, you know, these two could be our forward pairing for years. But he doesn't have the ruthlessness to be scoring regularly in the games we need him to. And I've looked back through his goals, and I think it's only one open play goal against top six opposition in the last 2.5 years in the Premier League, and that was the goal against Tottenham in the 3-1 earlier this season.
Wow, that is an interesting stat. I have to say that's very interesting, because I would have said, you know, from memory that it seemed to be when he signed the contract, when he signed the infamous contract, and suddenly started getting whatever it is, 250k a week. That he stopped being quite as ruthless and effective as he was. I think there were two seasons, wasn't he, when he was joint top scorer. He was joint Golden Boot. Yeah. And, you know, and considering he was
won it one season, then right. He was one behind Vardy right. The season. He missed that. Right. He missed that sitter on the final day that would have taken him level.
Yeah. But my memory of him in those days, you know, was that we loved him. We absolutely loved him. And I think this is probably going to play into your general theory that that fans are too willing to love, and, you know. But I remember being massively, almost universally loved as a bit of the answer to our striking prayers that we had for quite a long time previously. And I think there were issues like where do you play him, because we were trying to play him with Lacazette, and quite annoyingly, you know, very rarely did Lacazette play just behind him in a kind of vague 4-4-1-1. It was always, you know, all brought wide, blah blah blah, and that was constantly a thing, wasn't it, which kind of slightly affected him. But I just remember him being pretty fantastic, you know, in at his height. And then seemed to drop off massively since he signed this new contract. And that may be, I do agree with what you're saying. I think your description of him is hard to argue against when you consider that he seems to be happy being a superstar, like a very famous star who's, you know, kind of loved, you know, by a big section of the Arsenal fans, and I guess in Gabon, you know, everyone there, rather than, as you say, coming up with the goods when you really, really need him to as a striker. And that is, I mean, it's hard to argue against that. I have to agree with you. I can see them not selling him though, because if they try and get some money for him in January, who's going to buy him? And people keep saying Barcelona, but can they afford his wages? I think that has to be a big question. I'm not sure if there's much of many people are going to be clamoring for him. Is he 32? I can see
32.
Yeah, 32. I can see him Lacazette staying till, you know, I really can. Especially the way we run things, you know. I'd be slightly surprised if they did sell him. And especially because I can't see them, who they're going to, you know. Are you saying then we would then rely on, you know, Lacazette, Martinelli? I mean, surely Eddie Nketiah, they must be trying to sell him still. So I think we need a proper, the striking department has suddenly become a real problem, isn't it, like for us?
Well, I actually think the Nketiah decision can only be based on putting him in the shop window. But
right.
In some ways, I don't know how that stacks up against getting the result in the here and now. As you said, you know, if he's sitting on the bench and you're thinking, if he comes on and scores a goal here against Everton or United, it will look good to those kind of mid-table clubs that suddenly think an ex-Arsenal player is the answer to your prayers. It isn't. Look at Everton and Iwobi.
Yeah.
Look at Welbeck and people like that. You know, if our players that we pass on, if we can get good money for them and have done down the years, then it's almost a badge of honour to have come out of our youth team, even though it's only recently that youth team has started to deliver. I'm going to end it on a positive to say that Balogun looks outstanding. I mean, we've had years and years and years of hype, and I can reel off a few of the names and you could probably add your own to it, but J. Emmanuel Thomas, Sanchez Watt, Tuba Akpom. We've had players that have ripped up that reserve youth level of the club and the under 23 level of the club, where, I mean, even Nketiah did as well, where we think, this is the next big player for Arsenal. Look at the goal scoring record. And it's never, ever been sustained into the first team. But Balogun has a different aspect to his game. And I'm hoping that the way we took a chance on making Saka and Smith Rowe huge parts of our team, just as it looked really bleak last season, hand forced, here's two players that, you know, are going to come in and play and it worked. I think, you know, he needs to go for the hat trick there and put Balogun in and see if it works with him.
But he's not even on the bench, is he? Yet? I mean, you know, at the moment he seems down the pecking order. And
but this is it. I mean, he's 20. I mean, that's he should have had more first team games.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd have him in there. Yeah, instead of Nketiah,
he's filled out as well.
Right.
Boy, he's filled out. You know, his goals against Southampton yesterday. If you seek him out online, they're actually he's tweeted a few of his highlights.
Yeah,
actually.
I had a look. Yeah, I saw it. Great.
He's filled out, and he's you know, he's not getting pushed off the ball anymore.
Yeah.
And there was an amazing penalty he won. The game they played at the Emirates, I forget which game, I forget who the opposition was. It might have been Derby or someone like that. Leicester, actually. He took the ball past the player and won the penalty in the same move. And he's not getting pushed off the ball anymore. I genuinely think you've got to put him in.
Yeah,
he'll be erratic, he'll be unpredictable, and he'll get minutes in what is another season we're prepared to say to Arteta, show us a bit of improvement and... We're assuming that the guys in charge are going to keep you at the club anyway. So,
what
was your best part of last season? Mine was Smith Rowe and Saka.
Yeah, 100%.
So, therefore, if you can say that again next season, and then there's three of them on the pitch, and the others all contribute because the signings have been good, and Ramsdale's been good, to me, that's maybe the next thing you can hope for. And be positive about.
Yeah, and you hope that they might. And you hope they might bring in a top level manager who can get that team to further heights.
I mean, I think just looking at the organisation and way that other teams play, I think there is another side of managing a team in the Premier League that Arteta just hasn't grasped at all.
Yeah, that's
the bit that we're lacking. And it might only be 20%, but 20% is huge. You know, he might have 80% of all the every little compartment of being a good manager in the Premier League. But I still think he's not the full package. And there's a little bit that you maybe just can't learn. And a lot don't get the chance to do it because, you saw with Lampard, he won't get a Premier League job again. You wouldn't have thought.
Well, same because with Solskjaer.
I think Solskjaer is a bigger joke in that respect because he did have the chance. You know, he did have the Cardiff time. He did have the time at Mould. You don't get many chances. You've got to. I don't think we ever. There must be an example of it, but I don't think we ever see managers fail so badly. In a good, you know, in a big first job that they then are successful. I don't think.
No.
I think that the perception of you, even by your players, you know, if you come in on a day when you're appointed 3 years after you've failed somewhere else, the immediate attitude from the players against you, because everything can be watched now, everything can be looked at online, might be, I'm not going to respond to this guy.
Mm.
So he's got to make it now, Arteta, and I still think he's just not there. I don't think he ever will be.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
It's a shame. But I don't have the same loyalty towards him in terms of him being a legendary Arsenal player.
Oh,
I really
no.
don't think he was at all.
He was a legend. Oh, no, I say this all the time.
That's what Solskjaer lived off.
Yeah, yeah. Solskjaer was. They love that. Yeah, he's a proper United legend, but there's nothing, absolutely nothing about Arteta that.
I mean, they still love him now.
Yeah, right, yeah. I mean, that's why I think even if at the end of the season we're seventh or eighth, I mean, sixth, seventh, eighth, whatever, I feel like if at the end of the season it's quite clear he's gone as far as he can go, then even Patrick Vieira would be preferable because Patrick Vieira is a legend. I mean, he really is a fucking legend, you know. And I just feel like as you say, I think the margins are so small that even though it seems a bit ridiculous to say, I still think like your presence in the dressing room and the charisma you exude, if you are a legend, and clearly Solskjaer, in fact, was quite funny because he was so uncharismatic that it clearly cuts that. But whereas Vieira, I feel someone like him, an actual legend of the team, would command respect and listen to him way more than Arteta, or just that little bit more than Arteta that could make a difference between seventh, eighth, and fourth, fifth. And so you know, we'll see. We'll see. But we need to wrap up with the game this week, Alan, is like your two teams against each other, Arsenal, West Ham.
My son even saying to me, who are you going to be cheering on?
Yeah.
What an insult.
But I mean, luckily or unluckily for us, West Ham having a slightly not great patch, aren't they? They, you know.
This is a good time to play West Ham. It's mainly around the fact that they, for the last 110 minutes of Premier League football, they've been without their, what you would deem, their first choice right back, left back, and both centre backs. All four of their first choice defenders have been out the last 110 Premier League minutes. 20 of those were against Chelsea at home, and 90 of those were against Burnley at the weekend in the Premier League. I will say, though, they haven't conceded in any of those 110 minutes, which is bizarre.
Yeah.
But you would think Cresswell might be back, so he might come in for Masuaku at left back. But you're looking at a back four, which will be Kafau, who had lost his place to Johnson until Johnson got his hamstring injury, and then Diop and Dawson, who had both lost their places at the centre-back. So they're all competent players across that back line, but they are deemed to be sort of second and third choice in some of the spots. So it should be a good chance for us to get onto them and make sure that we're trying to exploit that. Especially Dawson, because I think he might struggle against the type of players that we have and the way that we play. But they're all good players, and it's going to be a tough game. I think elsewhere on the pitch, they have been outstanding the last few weeks. Bowen is just incredible. Antonio's been a little bit quiet, and he wasn't that great yesterday by all accounts. So I'm wondering, if he might be dropped or come off after 60 minutes. Sometimes he does that. They haven't got many options beyond him other than putting Bowen or Yarmolenko there. I think this is a good time to play them. And I think if we play like we did on Saturday, barring the first 20 minutes, I think we'll nick this 1-0.
Wow. Which would go fourth, wouldn't we?
Which would mean we go fourth, yeah.
Incredible, yeah. I've kind of got a feeling we'll win as well. Yeah, I think 2-1. But I'm excited by the fact that you think that we're going to win. That means
something.
Think
if I'm going to call one result right, it's the two teams I watch the most.
So exactly.
I would hope I get this right.
Exactly.
Boyd, you will remember Josh told you about my interaction with the guy who does the announcements.
Yes, 100%. Yes.
It was a strange one because he does listen to the
amazing
podcast. He heard my, and I did listen back to make sure they were constructive rather than insulting criticisms of his style and the way he sounds on there. They've turned him up a bit more, which is great. He's got a hell of a lot better. And I think one thing I said at the time, and I want to reiterate, is the fact that I think we're a good club for being able to give young people local to Arsenal opportunities to actually do stuff and work with the club.
Yeah.
So, and he has been massively improved recently. And I want to give him a shout out because
that's lovely. That's heartwarming. Yeah. What's his name?
He's a good guy. He's on Twitter as Pete on Pole. His first name is Pete.
Okay. I forgot to mention it's going to be interesting on Wednesday because this is the first post-COVID Plan B game, isn't it, where we all have to show our proof that we haven't got COVID either through a passport, through the app, through the NHS app, or
so
showing.
I believe season ticket holders are going to have the opportunity to respond to and I might have got this wrong, but from what I've seen, respond to an email.
Yes.
And then it will be uploaded to your card so that when you go through, you can just breeze through.
Yes.
Is that right?
I've got that email where, I haven't clicked on it yet. But it does.
I've just seen a copy of someone's, and it says you only have to do it once, and it corresponds with your season ticket.
Yeah, oh, that's good then. Yeah, okay, fine. So it should be okay in theory. It shouldn't cause massive delays. That's what.
So they'll only be checking people that don't have season tickets, I guess.
Right.
Which would be what 30%, 40% of the stadium, maybe. But
I tell you what it does say, though. Just to say, it says, please click the button below to submit your declaration, right? So you fill in this declaration form. And then it says, by making this declaration, when attending a game at the Emirates, you agree to bring a valid COVID pass or proof of negative lateral flow test. So you still have to bring that thing. And they're saying they're still going to test, they're still going to... not to challenge everyone, but there will be spot checks. So, yeah. I mean...
But really, it doesn't really matter then if no. you're a season ticket holder. You just got to have the app, whether you've got to have the, you bought a ticket outside or not. Yeah.
I predict pandemonium. I noticed as well that one of the scoreboards didn't work. One of the scoreboards, the two scoreboards didn't work at all. Having achieved the dream of the two lineups alongside each other in the previous home game, one of the screens was completely blank for the whole fucking game, was in hashtag Arsenal Shambles news. And I must say that I had to queue up for fish and chips at halftime. There was a chip shortage in the on club level, and it was. I really felt sorry for the poor guy doling them out because people were getting furious, and you had to be literally waiting there for like watch. And the poor guy was like, "It's not my fault. There's a chip deliverer, you know, whose job it is to deliver chips." I was like, "Oh my god, this is such classic Arsenal." And he was like, "Yeah," he was like nodding away. You just feel sorry for the staff because, you know, hopefully he's a local or whatever, but it was another classic moment of Arsenal shambles that we couldn't get any fucking chips with the fish and chips.
And they played, and for some inexplicable reason, after us consigning it to the dustbin, they played Sweet Caroline with 20 minutes prior to kickoff.
Oh, sick. Absolutely sick. Yeah, terrible.
That can't happen again.
No, still major issues with the situation at Arsenal in all kinds of ways. Yeah. Anyway, it's been thanks so much, Alan, for joining us for this one-on-one special.
Pleasure, very enjoyable.
And I hope your prediction for the West Ham game is absolutely right. And we'll be back next week. Thanks a lot. Bye.
If you want to advertise on or sponsor this show, check us out at playbackmedia.co.uk.
Sports Social Podcast Network.